It's moving.
Thank you.
I think if you try to put the court nose down, all right. Now, amongst your senses that he has some strength, goes to war with Edmund and wins the war with Edmund. He comes back, and in the spoil, he brings back some of the idols of Edom, brings them back to Jerusalem, and worships them there. And the prophet says to him, "But how foolish you are. These idols couldn't even help the Edomites. They failed the Edomites. They lost the war. And you bring them back and you worship them." And we'll have something more to say about that later this morning. Yo, Amatio now, since he's won the battle, and it would have been better for Amatio had he lost the war with Edom. And that happens very often to us in life. We achieve some great victory. It might have been better hadn't we achieved that great victory. Amatio has this victory, and now his next step is, first step, brings the idols back with him. His next step is, he challenges Yehoash to warfare. It is true that there was a certain amount of provocation, but it would have been worthwhile to have overlooked that. Yehoash appeals to him not to go to war. Yehoash says, "I'm stronger than you." He ignores that, goes to war with Yehoash, and loses the battle. Now we are busy with Yehoash. It would have been better for Yehoash had he not won the war with Amatio, as so often happens in life. And we mustn't think that when we lose, that this is a terrible calamity. Sometimes we gain more by having lost than we would have gained by having won. And these two cases are the illustration of it. We are now at the end of where this war took place, and we are told, if we just turn to verse 13 of chapter 14 in the second book of Kings. Kings 2, chapter 14, verse 13. Now, Ve'eis Amatio Melech Yehudo ben Yehoash ben Achaziyahu, Tofas Yehoash Melech Yisrael Ve'vei Shomesh. And Yehoash captured Amatio, the king of Judah. Yehoash, the king of Israel, captured Amatio, the king of Judah, by your bow Yerushalayim, and he came to Jerusalem, by your bow who? They came to Jerusalem. There's a difference between the Kri and the Kasiv. It's written, "and they came," but it's read, "by your bow and he came," because he's really the one who came. Amatio came as a captive back to his own city, to his own capital. By Euphrates, Bechomas, Yerushalayim, Beshar, Ephraim, Achad, Abuna, Arba, Meas, Amo. And this is something that the kings used to do when they came to the capital of the country that they had conquered, and it was a walled city. They never entered by any special gate, but they made a breach in the wall, and they entered through that breach. They made their own gate to enter the city. So he makes a breach of 400 cubits, which is a very bright breach. It's a minimum of 600 feet. Ve'lokach eskola zol v'yakeseh ve'eskola kelim aninzikim beis Hashem uva'otzos beis HaMelech ve'es b'nei ha'taruvos v'yoshev shemrelo. And he takes the gold and the silver and all the vessels that were found in the Beis Hashem, that's in the Beis HaMikdosh, in the temple, and he takes the treasures of the king's palace and he brings them to Shaul. A great victory for Yahush, the king of Shaul. And then this is the end. Behesed Dibra Yahush Ashur Gurusaraka Asher Nilcham Ima Matsyo Melech Yehudo. The rest of his acts and his heroism, which he showed when he fought with the Matsyo, the king of Judah, Alohim Kusubi Malsefer Dibra Yomim Malkin Israel. They are written in the books of the kings, the chronicles of the kings of Israel. And now Jeroboam, or Yerobam, his son, and this is the second Yerobam, because the first king of the northern kingdom was Yerobam ben Naboth. Now it is another Yerobam, Yerobam the son of Yehosh. You might ask, since Yerobam was such a wicked king, what is the idea of Yehosh giving his son the same name as such a wicked king? We're going to speak about that a little today. If we would have seen Yerobam ben Naboth, we would never have looked upon him as a wicked person. You could be quite sure he put on his tefillin every morning. You can be quite sure he davened three times a day. You can be quite sure he learned Gemara every day. You can be quite sure he had tremendous charisma. You would have been overpowered by his gentlemanliness and by his derech eretz. What was wrong with you, Robert? In Deos, in his emuno, in his ideas, that is where the fault lay. As far as he was concerned, a highly presentable person. And why did he have these ideas? He was in the position of king. He couldn't take it that his kingdom had to be secondary to the southern kingdom. That he couldn't take. That he had to be secondary to the king of Judah, who was the son of Shlomo HaMelech. And Jeroboam might have been a greater man than he. That is something that he couldn't take. And what did he do? He twisted matters to suit his own purpose, and Yah laid his own path. In his ideas, as far as his actions are concerned, excepting those actions which followed upon those ideas, that was bad. But Yerobam ben Naboth, to such an extent that Hashem says to Yerobam ben Naboth, Yerobam, you've still got a chance. And you and I and David HaMelech will walk together in Gan Eden. And he says, and who will be at the head? And Hashem says, David. He says, no, I don't want that. That was wrong with the man. So Yehosh had no great qualms about naming his son Yerobam. And Amatzio, what happens to him? Let us finish him or two. Vayechi Amatzio ben Yehosh melech Yehuda acharei mos Yehosh ben Yehoahaz Melech Yisrael, Chamesh Esrei Shono. Yehosh dies before his time. Amatzio, so to say, lives after his time, lives another 15 years. In the same way as it would have been better for Amatzio had he lost the battle with Edom, he would have been better off. So would it have been better off for Yehosh had he lost the battle with Amatzio. he didn't do him any good. His pride and his arrogance, taking away the treasures from Jerusalem, bringing them to Shomron, displaying them in Shomron, all that demonstration, the result of it was he dies before his time, and Amatzio continues to live for another 15 years. And if you will help me, I want to finish this chapter before we have any discussions. And then he tells us in verse 18, in verse 17, now Yehoash is dead, and Jeroboam, his son, is reigning in Israel, in the northern kingdom. Vayechi Amatzio ben Yehoash melech Yehuda acharei mos Yehoash, Oshmelech ben Yehoahaz melech Israel, Hamesh Esrei Shono. Amatzio lives 15 years after the death of Yehoash. And this is, he paid a lot for the wrongs he did. Lives another 15 years. The rest of the acts of Amatzio are written in the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah. Verse 19, Vayikshulu olof kesher Yerushalayim vayonos lochisho. And they rebelled against him in Jerusalem, and he fled to Lochish. Vayishlu achrov lochisho v'yemisuhu shom. And they sent after him to Lochish, and they put him to death there. Now what actually happened, and we understand this from the gaps here that are filled in Divrei Hayomim, in our book of Chronicles. What happens here is that after the death of Yehoash, Amatzio remains on in Jerusalem for 3 years. There is a rebellion that takes place. He flees from Jerusalem to Lochish. He carries on in Lochish for another 12 years. That is the 15 years altogether. By Yisrael, so Alasusi, and then after the 12 further years, he is killed in Lochish. So, the rebellion takes place, he carries on for 3 years, the rebellion takes place, he must flee to Lochish, and after another 12 years, those who rebelled against him in Jerusalem put him to death in Lochish. Right? And he just tells us, and they brought his body by Yisrael ala Susi, they brought, put his body on horses, by Hikobe Yerushalayim, Ima Vesok Yedobi, he was buried in Jerusalem together with his fathers in the city of David. His son was Azario. So after 3 years, when he fled to Lochish, they took his son Azario and made him king in Jerusalem in his stead. So Amatzio was in exile in Lochish, and his son Azario reigned in Jerusalem. The reason for the rebellion was that the people were better than the king. When he came back, when Amatzio came back from this battle that they had fought victoriously in Edom, brought back the idols with him, Jerusalem was a great city, with the base of Mikdosh and with its colony. They couldn't take this from Amatzio. We discussed last time that this war which he fought, Hashem brought it about. Didn't help him at all. And the prophets warned him. And the prophet said, you must know that Hashem wants you to go to this battle because it will be your downfall. The people were greater than their king. And since the people were greater than their king, after this battle, he still had the power to carry on for 3 years. Then they rebelled, disposed him, and he went to Lochish. And after another 12 years, with Azario his son in Jerusalem, they became, those who opposed him became so powerful that they were able to bring about his assassination in Lachish. And that is the end of Amatzio. Now we've got Azario, his son. And in verse, does it sound very confusing to you? I'm trying to make it just as simple as I possibly can. And we'll just get over this part. Tamar, do you want to ask something?
Usually, if a man is wicked, his son, you know, with Yeridat HaDorot, you would think his son would be a lesser man than he, or even perhaps more wicked than he. Why would they have his son in his stead?
We'll soon come to that. When I say soon, I'm thinking that is a part where we get the great Chizkiyahu, the son of a wicked father. And what a great king. And he has a son. And the son is a wicked man of a great father. And he has a son. Who is a great man, the grandson of a great father, the son. All those things. And just the simple answer is that this is what the Gemara tells us, that a child inherits from its parents physical appearance, intelligence, temperament, which is inextricably bound up with character, length of days. That is what a son inherits from a father, or a daughter from its parents. All those things, one thing is not inherited. Yerushalayim. That is, you've got to get yourself.
Fear
of Hashem. Fear of Hashem, it means, I don't like translating these words.
No.
I call it religion, and the whole thing just crumbles to pieces. Doesn't mean anything anymore.
You mean a father who has that good characteristic can't teach it to his son?
He can teach it, but he doesn't get it automatically. He doesn't get it automatically. His temperament he can inherit. His intelligence he can inherit.
Right,
he teaches
it, but
his appearance he can inherit.
You're saying that
his physique he can inherit.
Even if they teach it, it might not work.
Oh, teaching, yes.
So you're saying,
but then he doesn't inherit it. A father teaches his son, but if he just leaves his son will have the intelligence of the father. His son will have the physique of the father. The son might have the same color eyes as his mother has got.
How does it skip generations?
What skips generations?
You just spoke about a wicked father and a good son, and a wicked son and a good father.
How does that happen? We'll come to that. I don't want to deal with it just at this particular moment. I want to finish this chapter. Will you remember to ask me that? Remember to ask me that, please. Now, in verse 21, Bahichu kol am Yehudu es Azario, all the people of Judah take Azario, that's the son of Amatzio, the who ben sheis esrei shono, and he was 16 years old. But they take him not after the death of his father. They take him 12 years before his father dies. And they make him, when his father is disposed and in deposed, I'm sorry, when his father is deposed and in exile, and they crowned him king instead of his father Matsyo. Who bono es Eilat? He built Eilat. Va yeshiveho lihudo. And returned it to Judah. Now Eilat is where Eilat is today. And this was a place that Shlomo HaMelech conquered, and it was lost. So Azario is able to rebuild Eilat and to bring it back, get it back for Judah, and it becomes the property of Judah. Who bono is Eilat, that it must be said, it was part of his father's doing because his father won the battle against Edom. Who bono is Eilat, the Yeshiveri Yehudo, rebuilt Eilat, returned it to Judah, Achrei Shechava Melechim Abezo, after Amatzio's death. Bishnach Chamech Esrei Shona La Amatzio Ben Yehosh Melech Yehudo, Molech Yerobam Ben Yehosh Melech Yisrael Veshomer Marboim Achrei Shona. Now we leave the southern kingdom, we go back to the northern kingdom, and there it's Yerobam, who is now Jeroboam, he's known as Jeroboam II, he is the king of the northern kingdom. What a good king. Vayaso Robanei Hashem, he does evil in the eyes of Hashem. Lo sov mikol chatins Yerobam ben Nevat, doesn't turn aside from all the sins of Yerobam ben Nevat, Asher hechati Yisrael, which he caused Israel to sin. Hu heishiv eskabul Yisrael milevo chamos ad yomu arobo. He returned the borders of Israel to what they were before, from as you come to Hamos until the sea of the desert. Kivar Hashem Elohekei Yisrael, according to the word of Hashem, the God of Israel, Hashem Yibir B'yad Avde Yelno Ben Amitai, which he spoke through his servant, Yono the son of Ben Amitai, that is the same Yono as the Yono of the whale, Anobi the prophet, Hashem Gata Hefer, who was from Gata Hefer. Ki ro Hashem is only Israel Mole Me'ol, because Hashem saw the poverty of Israel, which was frightening, the Ephes or Tzu, the Ephes or Zu, the Ein Ozeh the Israel. There was nothing left, whether it was in the cities or whether it was in the fields, and there was no help for Israel. The Lord Diber Hashem Libchos Eshem Israel Mitachas Hashemayim. Hashem did not want to wipe out the name of Israel from under the heavens. By Yoshi Ein B'Yad Yerobam Ben Yerosh, and he saved them through Yerobam Ben Yerosh. And so Yerobam Ben Yerosh, he was a king, not considered a good king, did evil in the eyes of Hashem. Hashem used him as an instrument and saves Israel. Not because they were good, but they had come to such a low ebb that hadn't Hashem intervened, they would have been wiped out by their surrounding enemies. And Hashem still saves Israel. Still saves them. We are soon going to come to the stage where they are beyond redemption, and then Israel falls to Assyria, and that is the end of the Northern Kingdom. But we still have a little while to go. Mrs. Lippman, did you want to ask, or was it Robin? Yes.
When you say that Israel felt such a low, you're talking the whole of
only the Northern Kingdom.
Okay.
The Northern Kingdom is Israel, the Southern Kingdom is Judah.
Right. Okay, and they are, you're talking morally, they are now at a low end, as they were.
No, morally, economically, everything. Politically, everything. And it's Yerobam ben Nevat, Yerobam ben Yehosh, who in spite of his being a bad king, a wicked king, nevertheless, he is the one, through his diplomacy, through his military endeavors, Hashem is with him, and he's able to sustain the land. And it says, "V'yeted Yisrael Yerobam v'chol asher oso ugeburo so Hashem ilcham," and the rest of the acts of Yerobam, and all he did, and his heroism which he showed when he fought, "V'asher hasted his damitzes v'eschamos v'yudah v'Yisrael," and how he returned Damascus and Hamas to Israel, Alohein Kesuvim Malseva Divrei Yovim Malkei Israel. There again, the records are in the books of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. By Yishkav Yerobam Imam Ben Sovi Malkei Israel, by Yimlo Tzachar Yerobam Tachto. And Yerobam lies with his father, and Tzachar Yerobam, his son, reigns in his stead. So in the southern kingdom you've got a king Azaryo, and in the northern kingdom you've got the theme, Zechariah. It would appear that the author, Yirmiyahu, just wants us, to confuse us as much as possible. If they're not the same names, they are similarly sounding names. And now we've got Azariah in the southern kingdom, Zechariah in the northern kingdom. Now, for a couple of chapters, but not for long, really for one chapter and perhaps a little bit more, the pace is a pedestrian pace now, both in the south and in the north. And you would have to bear with me whilst we plod through this next chapter, but there's always something that we will pick up on the way. And now, just a few things before we adjourn for our tea break. This is actually a Mishnah that a son inherits, or a daughter. A son inherits and a daughter inherits the physique, the appearance of parents, the intelligence of parents, the temperament of parents, the length of years, longevity of parents. Now, I know that that is so because I took out an insurance policy once, a life insurance policy, and they asked me questions. Age of my father, age of my mother, how long did they live, how long did the grandparents live? I said, what business is it of yours? Say, you're a very good risk. There's longevity in your family. Where does Hashem come into it? Where does Hashem come into it? We know that if a person has got length of years, Hashem wants him to have length of years. Yeah, the Mishnah itself, if you please, tells us, how long did your parents live? Yet you get some idea whether you will have length of years or you won't have length of years. Where does Hashem come into it? We live as long as we deserve to live. But we also live as long as we are needed to live. And now I want to explain to you. You've heard me say from time to time that every single person in the world is born for a purpose. Every single Jew is born for a dual purpose. First of all, he has his specific purpose as an individual. Secondly, he has his specific purpose as a Jew. And his specific purpose as a Jew is to bring godliness into the world. That is his work. Every single person has a purpose in this world, be he Jew or Gentile. Every nation has its purpose in the world. Not only every individual and every nation, every family has its purpose in the world. Of course, I'm speaking about the position as it is and as it should be. I'm not speaking about the position as the world has made it and as we have made it. You'll find that certain things go in families. I can name to you families in the Torah world. And these families go back generations and generations and generations. They are Torah people in the sense that they teach Torah. That is their work. And they fulfill it. And the children come into the world and there's just no question what they are going to do and what they are going to be. Possible that a man has 10 children. It's possible that 2 don't follow in the way, but 8 do. And that continues. I meant by calling it a family tradition, I like calling it the purposefulness in the family. And so you've got families that has gone on and on. We speak about the Gaon, the Vilna Gaon. The Soloveitchik family comes down from the Vilna Gaon. And you know that that family, it just goes on and on. And you know, it's with the children and the grandchildren, it just goes on and on. Some to a greater degree, some to a lesser degree, but they fulfill their purpose in the world. There are dozens of families like that. I could name to you families, not Jewish families. You've got, in the English tradition, a family like the Haldanes. They are scientists. And it goes on and on in that family. Sometimes a family is destined for a particular purpose, and that purpose requires longevity. So longevity is in that family. That is what it means. If you take a family of Torah teaching, you've got to have longevity there. Takes a long time to impart Torah. And what is very bad is, it is always chopping and changing. That is a real case of a rolling stone gathers no moss. So, a Talmid must be able to be with his teacher for a certain length of time. Otherwise, it's not going to work. And so you've got longevity in that. But there is a reason for it. That is something that is necessary for the purposefulness of families. There is one thing that cannot be inherited under any circumstances, and that is Yirat Shamayim. Hakol bidei shamayim chutz miyirat shamayim. Everything is in the hand of heaven. Hashem can give a person anything. There is one thing that Hashem will not give a person, and that is Yirat Shamayim. That a person must get himself. Now, a person can be born more intelligent than another person. Is that fair? A person can be born with a better temperament than another person. Some people are born good and some people are born bad. I know that very well. I was born naughty. Is it fair? Get a person who is born good and you get a person who is born naughty. It's not fair. All equals out. Sometimes it's better to be born naughty than it is to be born good. Depends what the person makes of. To be born good is more difficult than to be born naughty. Depends what the person makes of. It all equals out. Lefum tzaro adno. The agro, now agro isn't really reward, it's not really schar. Agro is really the outcome of one's efforts. Lefum tzaro agro. The outcome of one's efforts is dependent on the tzar. It doesn't say it is dependent on the effort. It doesn't say it's dependent on the work. It's dependent on the tsar. It's dependent on the pain that goes into it. Work isn't sufficient. Labor isn't sufficient. Toil isn't sufficient. Sweat isn't sufficient. What we need, tears and blood, then you pray. Tears and blood, and then you pray. Requires a lot of work. And the full tsaro agro, it's when you come to that stage that the real outcome is there. Now, please don't for one moment think that the only way we can achieve progress in total is through blood and tears, and don't let that be pressed. I'm not at that stage, and I don't think you are quite at that stage. We're at the stage where we work. Don't fear the stage of blood, of tears and blood, if it ever comes to that. Don't fear it. Because when it comes to it, if it ever comes to that, there will be nothing that you will value so much as the blood and tears. So don't worry about that. All we have got to do is to work, and we have got to progress. And now, before I leave that subject, I just want to tell you one thing. It doesn't work that, first of all, there's work, then when you pass that level, you ascend to the level of labor, when you pass that labor to toil, when you pass that toil to tears and to sweat, when you pass that toil to tears, and when you pass that toil to blood, it doesn't work that. When you work, and if you work sincerely and truthfully, be-emes, with the middle of emes, with the middle, with the attribute of truth, when you work like that, you will have a little bit, although you're only working, you will have a little bit of the toil, a little bit of the labor, a little bit of the sweat, a little bit of the tears, and a little bit of the blood, if you're working it properly. There are the aggravations. When you're working for Torah, don't think it's free of aggravation. And I'm not speaking the work in the community, I'm speaking the work that one does with oneself, on oneself. All that is there, to a very, very small degree. But it is there. And it is that that is really the making of us all. Let us adjourn for a few minutes.
We have a Seymour tonight.
Yes, we'll be
trying to use those.
Boats, and there is the leader, and the leader brings his little son with him. And they land in England, and the Britons, as they were then, before they were Anglo-Saxons, and the Britons fought this landing force of Vikings and killed them. Some managed to escape, but the little boy, they got the little boy. The father was killed, but they kept the little boy. And he traces the life of this little boy throughout the generations. And it goes about 600 or 700 years. And as the generations goes on, he describes, you find that there is a mayor of a little town. And he is the leader of this little town. And he is a descendant of this little boy that was captured, who was the son of the chief. And then he describes a person who wallows in the mud and in the gutter, and he's a drunkard. And then another person, very ordinary person. And then all of a sudden, something extraordinary comes, and the leadership is out again. And you find that he leads the army into battle, and he's a general. And then again there is a lapse of generations, and it comes out again. And the final person, of course it's a story, and the final person he ends up is Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln. And that's how the book goes. But it's a very fine illustration of a thought, which is a true thought. That is a Torah thought. And although that part of it he doesn't speak about, he might not even know, but he senses it. He senses it. But he speaks not like a Torah person, of course. He speaks like a Gentile. But a Gentile who has made the observation that in a family there is this leadership. But what he fails to know is the purposefulness of it. That there's a purpose by Hashem that the family must be that. That is given into this family. He can only make the observation, but it's a very beautiful observation that he's made. He does it extremely well, and his preface is very good. When he writes in the preface, we come across a person like Shakespeare, and we cannot understand how out of such a background there can be such genius. And he says, but you don't know who his ancestors were 200 and 300 years ago. That you don't know. You think that suddenly there's genius. It comes from somewhere. And he actually gives the example of Shakespeare, if I remember it correctly. And so this is what we find, that is really, that is a Torah idea. All these things are given man, excepting Yirah Shamayim. That's the only thing that isn't given to him. Carol asked me a question, and I explained to her that that doesn't mean to say that Hashem doesn't give one the opportunities, that Hashem doesn't create for one the circumstances, but all the circumstances can be there, and all the opportunities can be there, and the human being, the individual, can spurn them, and of course then it is to no avail. But Yirah Shamayim is something that a person must have on his own. That he must get. And now, I want to come on to a further subject. And that is, we go through the Book of Kings, and we find these different kings. Some of them are good, some of them are evil. As we read it, we gain the impression that not only the majority are evil, but the majority of the majority are evil. How many good kings have you got altogether? And I must make you aware of something, and unless you are aware of that, we can never have an appreciation of the Nevi'im, the period of the Nevi'im. And that is that what is stressed are the flaws and the faults and the mistakes and the failings of the men. That is what is stressed, because it is from that that we learn. That is what the prophets were there for, to admonish, to correct, to teach. And don't for one moment think that they weren't successful. Whatever lapses there were, they were still successful. And we still draw from all that. We are still the product of all that admonishment and of all that teaching which took place by the prophets. And the prophets that admonished the kings, their writings, we have got them in the book of Isaiah, in the book of Amos, in the book of Hosea. All those writings we have still got, where that admonishment is there. And one day I hope we'll be able to take a chapter or two out of Isaiah and deal with it, and see how it fits into all this period. Now, these are the lives of the kings. As the whole book takes the failings of the kings, their shortcomings, and deals with that, and highlights it, I want you to know that in the life of every individual king, there were very great factors. What happens is that the book takes the failings of the king deals with their failings, because these from those are the things from which we are going to learn. But we must know what great people they were. Now, it is difficult for us to understand sometimes how it is that when there was such greatness and when they saw so much, that at the same time they were able to go astray to the extent that they went astray. The greatest stumbling block in the days of the kings, the greatest stumbling block was Avodah Zarah, idolatry. And I dealt with it at the last shiur. I showed you that it's not as strange as we think it is. Of course, Manasseh, who was a bad king, told you the story of how in the dream he comes to one of the great men of earth, hundreds of years later, where this man said that Ashir took Manasseh as an example of idolatry, and in his dream he asked him a question, and this authority was unable to answer. Manasseh answered it. He said, well, this is the answer to it, and that is the way you spoke about me. Not very nice. And he said, tell me one thing. If you are so learned, and you were so learned, how could you serve idolatry? He said, if you were living in my day, you would have picked up your skirts and you would have run in order to serve idolatry. So don't you haven't got the gates of Allah. Hashem took it away from us. But it has remained with us. And we still have idolatrous tendencies. We still believe in certain things in the world that they can save us. Whether it is the economy of the country can save us, on it yesterday afternoon. We read the story of the golden calf. There are just one or two things that we must realize. And first of all, look what it says. After they had made the golden calf, by Yomaru, and they said, doesn't say who they are, but it says, they said, Eile Elohecho Yisrael, Asher He'eluchu Me'eretz Mitzrayim. This is your God, O Israel, who brought you out from the land of Egypt. There's something dramatically wrong with the sentence. They said, this is your God, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. What should they have said? This is our God who brought us out of the land of Egypt. Why say this is their God? There's only one explanation that you can give. And it's conclusive because there's no other explanation. That means that not everybody said it. That some people didn't say it. And this was the section of the people that said it to the section of the people that didn't say it. So one section of the people said, this is your God of Israel who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And the other section didn't say it. Which shows that it was only part of the people who worshipped, and not all the people. And part of the people wished to impose their will on the rest of the people. Who were the people that said, this is your God of Israel? Who were the people that didn't say so and didn't believe it? And as I mentioned yesterday, that even Ezra says that it was one half of a tenth of a tenth, which works out to one half of 1%. One half of 1% that made that said, this is your God of Israel who brought you out of the land of Egypt. But even that, then, one half of 1%, this was one half of 1%, who were they? We are told this was the Erev Rav. And that is, that when the Bnei Yisrael went out of Egypt, some of the Egyptians also attached themselves. They had seen such wonders they attached themselves to the Am Yisrael, came out of Egypt together with them. Now when it came to they crossed the Red Sea, they saw the miracle of the Red Sea, they stood at the foot of Mount Sinai, heard Hashem speaking to the people, knew that Moshe was up there, the experience itself, then they make that golden calf. How can one sink so low in so short a time after having had such extraordinary experiences? Yiras Shamayim is something that is different. I spoke to you last night about Hakara. Now, Hakara must have certain ingredients. And I am starting now to deal with some of the ingredients that is necessary in coming to a Hakara, in coming to any recognition of something. And we explained that Hakara was an evaluation of a matter or of a person exactly as it is. Nothing less, but exactly as it is. To have a Koras Hashem, that is to have a recognition of Hashem, exactly who He is. We know very few have it. Moshe Rabbeinu had it when he said, Ein Od Milvadeh. That when one comes to the end of it all, there is reality, and I know that logically this is not correct. But in practical life it is so. There is reality and there is absolute reality. When I drink water, the water is real. But it is only relatively real. Because the reality of it is that it is a gas and it's not a liquid. That it's hydrogen and oxygen. But for all practical purposes, on the practical level, this is the reality. And if I go up one level, and now I am on a higher level, there the reality of it is, on that level, the reality is that it is a gas. And if I leave that reality of oxygen and hydrogen, and I go up to a higher reality, then the lower reality was only a relative reality. And now I come to a higher reality. And the higher reality is that it's energy. Practically no matter at all. It's electrons and all sorts of particles. And it's energy that we are dealing with here. And I can go on still to a higher level. And each level is a world on its own. And when I come onto a higher level, then the reality of the previous level was only a relative reality. Until I can come to a stage, what I would call the reality of reality. So what is the reality of all realities? Moshe said, Ein Od Milvadeh. The reality of all realities is Hashem Himself. It's all very well for us to say so. I can't tell you that I can understand. I've got some idea of it. But on what a level one must be, even to understand it. And so we've got that telling Midrash, where the Midrash says, one deals with Israel. Now what it means for a man to have Hakara. He's got a car and he says, now I know that there is none like Hashem amongst the gods. The Midrash says, and he becomes a Jew. He gives credence to idolatry. None like Hashem amongst the gods. All you have to say is there's nothing like Hashem. But that is not what he reached. He defines exactly where he's come to. And this is greatness in an individual. To understand what he understands, exactly what it is. This is what he's able to do. I know exactly what I understand. Rochav, none like Hashem in the heavens above and on the earth below. Greater degree. Namon, a lesser degree. In Israel, I see that in Israel there is Hashem. Outside Israel, I can't see it. Maybe, but I can't see it. But in Israel, there is Hashem. That I can see. And in Israel, there is only Hashem. That he understands. And so, there are the levels of Hakara. Now, the essential in Hakara, the essential breathing in Hakara, the essential ingredient is Midas or Emes. And that is truth. To be able to get to the truth. It is one of the attributes of Hashem. Hashem, Hashem, Keil, Rachu, Vachanun, Erech Apayim, Rav Chesed, Ve'emes. So truth is one of the attributes of Hashem. And these are the attributes which we are expected to emulate. So it's a question of the truth. One cannot have Hakara without having truth. And so, if there is any question of having recognition of Hashem, or having recognition of a prayer that we are saying, whatever it is necessary to have the Midas or Emes, it is necessary to have the speed of truth. I must again say to you that this Midah of truth comes into the whole area of Yirah Shamayim. Without Yirah Shamayim, one doesn't get any of these to the depth of any of these Midahs. We, in this Shi'ur, are studying Tanakh, and we are studying Tanakh and adopting the only approach, which is the authentic approach. We don't study Tanakh as literature. We don't study it as history. It's neither literature nor history. It's very well written. But if it is wonderful literature, or if it is good literature, that is incidental. If we are able to gather historical facts from it, that is incidental. What is so important is that it is terrible. It deals with truth, and it deals with reality. That is what we have to understand. Now, do you know that all that we study is taught, and it is taught as literature? Do you know that all that we study is taught, and it is taught as history, and it's not taught as Torah at all? And you can get away with it. And books are written, libraries are written, about the Bible as literature. And the characters are dissected. And they are dissected as men and women of today. And you can get away with that. Literature, history, but it is not canon. Once it is Torah, the question of Yirah Shamayim comes into it. Here we've got how easy it is to go astray. we've got this whole incident of the Egel Azor of the Golden Calf, where the people went astray. What they went astray is a question of Yirat Shamayim. Now, we have dealt with this whole question of idolatry. And the way we understood it was when we see that we ourselves were subject to it. And how difficult it is not to be subject to it. To believe that everything is, in the final analysis, dependent upon Hashem. To the extent that Hashem won't do anything unless we do it. But we cannot achieve anything unless Hashem wants us to achieve it. And Hashem won't do anything unless we work for it and we do it. But we cannot have anything if Hashem doesn't want it. In the case of the golden calf, it took me many, many years to understand what the Chazal meant, and Rashi quotes it, that when the Am Yisrael went out of Egypt, crossed the Red Sea, stood on the other bank, they sang and they said, Zeh Eli Vi Anei, this is my God. Hakara, they came to a recognition of God at that moment. And then the Chazal and Rashi quotes it, makes the following remark. A handmaiden, when she stood on the shore of the Red Sea and looked back what she had gone through and what was happening to the pursuing Egyptians, saw as much as the greatest of prophets saw. A handmaiden. The Arab Rab also, that mixed multitude that came out together with the Am Yisrael, is included in that. They were able to see and they experienced what prophets, the greatest prophets, experienced. And the name of the prophet he's given is Ezekiel. They experienced it at that moment. And they take part. Those were the ones who were able to say, even if there were only 3,000 of them, those were the ones who were able to say about the God, this is your God, O Israel, who brought you out of Egypt. Of course, it is the idea embodied in the golden calf. And this is how we are going to carry on. The important thing to remember is that with each word that the Chazal say, they say a handmade soul. A handmaiden saw what the prophets were able to see afterwards, at that moment. He didn't say that the handmaiden became a prophet. You don't become a prophet by what you see and by what you experience. You become a prophet through work and labor and toil and sweat and tears and blood. And afterwards, you become a prophet. But without that, a handmaiden, and the experience, and nothing in between, still remains a handmaiden. The experience is over, back again to a handmaiden. Doesn't mean it. We can have the most stirring experiences. How long does it last? We are back into where we were. Once upon a time, when people studied Torah, now I'm going back to 1500 years. And that is exactly how long it is that this doesn't exist anymore. But until 1500 years ago, when people studied Torah, and they studied a book like Malachi, or they studied the Mishnah, or they studied the Gemara, they were able to take out of all that the enthusiasm that is necessary for Yirat Shamayim. Look how much Yirat Shamayim there is in Torah itself. After that, it wasn't like that anymore. After that, you could learn, and you wouldn't have Yirat Shamayim. For Yirat Shamayim, there had to be a separate struggle. And as a result of that, Musa started as a separate subject. Until that moment, there was also the subject of Musa, but it was incorporated in everything. It was incorporated in Torah. You didn't need any extra study for it, because in the Torah itself, you studied your Musa. Then it was a separate subject. And already 1500 years ago, we have the beginnings of it as a separate subject. The Ramban, he lived about 800 years ago. The Ramban, the middle of this period of 1500 years. The Ramban says that a person can obey and observe the Torah and be a Navar. That is, he can be a despicable person. Does everything that the Torah tells him to do. Keep Shabbos, keep Kashrut. Everything. And he can be a despicable person. Hasn't got Yirat Shamayim. That he hasn't got. Got it only on the surface. No depth to it whatsoever. I'm keeping you a little bit longer today. Does it matter? Keeping you a little bit longer today. Pesach is coming along. Purim is coming along. Pesach is an occasion to sit at the same table. One of the commandments with regarding to Pesach is that we must see ourselves, each one in his generation, as a person who has just gone out of Egypt, to realize why is this so important. Because there was a purpose in the redemption. The purpose in the redemption wasn't freedom, which really means license. That wasn't the purpose of the redemption. The redemption was not that they shouldn't be avodim, that they shouldn't be slaves. The purpose of redemption was that they should remain slaves. But proper slaves. Not slaves to Pharaoh. Not slaves to themselves. Slaves, but slaves to Hashem. What a difference. What a difference. To be an eved, but to be an eved to Hashem. And as long as they were slaves to Pharaoh and slaves to the Egyptians, can't be a slave to Hashem. One can't serve two masters. So they were freed from the bondage of Egypt. Freed from being avodim in Egypt, servants to Pharaoh, in order to be free and to be servants of Hashem. And Hashem says, they are my avodim, they are my servants, and the Jews are never to be servants of servants. They are my servants. That was the purpose of it. And since that was the purpose, each one today must experience that, that he is now being delivered in order that he can be a servant of Hashem. How does one experience it? Not only that, all right, the first time in one's life that one has to say that it's a great thing, but second year, third year, 10th year, 20th year, and it's all the same. All the same. Never changes. We've got to have some kind of hakara, some kind of recognition. It's interesting that in life, it's not the great things that leave the deepest impressions. It's the little things that leave the deep impressions. The great things make a tremendous impression, but it's all on the surface. And in no time it's gone. It's the little things that make the great impression. Depends how deeply it sinks in. How deeply it sinks in. According to the Deen, there must be questions asked at the Seder table. The children must ask the questions and the adults answering. What happens if there are no children at the table? Then the adults ask the questions and they answer. But the adults know the questions that they are going to ask, they are prescribed. The adults know the answers that they are going to receive. They are prescribed. The adult must ask the question, he must answer the question. Now I want to tell you a very interesting deen in the Choshen Mishpat. The Choshen Mishpat is that part of the Shulchan Aruch that deals with civil law. You've got a case of civil law. Two people come to the king who is the judge. They are two women. And there is a dead child and a live child. And the one woman says, the live child is mine and the dead child belongs to the other. And the other woman says, no, the live child is mine and the dead child belongs to the other. And the king says, well, all I can do is to divide the living child, give you half each. Says the real mother, no, let the other woman rather take it. Says the one who isn't real, no. That's a jolly good judge. And the judge and the king knows what he's about, and he knows exactly who is the real mother. An interesting thing happens. The king hears the case, and he repeats it. You say it's your child, you say it's your child. You say that it repeats. The din is that when a judge hears a case, and he's finishing hearing the case, before he gives a decision, before he gives judgment, he gives in a few words the essence of the plea of the plaintiff and the essence of the defense of the defendant. And then he gives the judgment. And that is the deal. That is the way he's got to do it. That is the way the Dayan has got to do it. When he repeats it, before he gives the decision, it sinks in. It just gives a chance for it to sink in. It says in the Torah, you are the Borim or Eile Asher Onuchi Metzabach Yomet Ayom. And these words which I command you this day shall be upon your heart. The Gemara asks a question, which I command you this day, but they were not commanded this day. And the commandment is to us. It must be on our heart. They weren't commanded this day. When were they commanded? Nearly 3,000 years ago. How can you say this day? It must be as if it was this day commanded to you this day. So fresh. Now that is an art that you can go through the Torah, and each time you go through it, it's as if fresh as if you've just experienced it now. Experienced it fresh. That is an art that all belongs to Hakara, recognizing something for what it is. Because each time you go into it, you're on another level. You are on another level, and you see it in another level. I just want to give you two examples. One of the greatest men that I've ever met was Reb Moshe Pogromansky. Reb Moshe Pogromansky. A couple of things about him. One couldn't fail but notice. He was a very creative thinker. Had an idea. I would go up and speak to him, and he would tell it to me. My friend would go up and speak to him afterwards. I told him, I've just heard something from that model. It's outstanding. My friend would go up to him. He would repeat to him exactly the same thing. A week later, I would go up and say to that model, tell it to me over again. He would tell it to me over again in that, with all that enthusiasm that he told it over to me the first time. All that enthusiasm, all that life in it, didn't fade. Once in Palanga, which was a bathing resort in Lithuania, that was the first time that I'd met Reb Moshe. First time I'd met him. And we met, and I said, I've got a few things that I would like to discuss with you. He said, all right. Tomorrow after shul, come and have breakfast with me. I went to have breakfast with him. On the way, we meet a man, and he goes to the motto, and he says, I have nothing to eat. So the motto said, come with us. We are going to have breakfast. Come with me. We sat down at the table. The motto sits here. I sat there. The stranger sat there. And we eat, and during the meal, the stranger turns to the motto and he says, I can't give you anything for the meal. I haven't got anything. So I will say to you some Torah. He doesn't know what Reb Moshe is, you see. He said, I'll tell Reb Moshe some Torah. I mean, you can understand. Reb Moshe is amongst the greatest. So Reb Moshe said, yes, of course, I'm an absolute gentleman. And Reb Moshe listens to it. He tells him over a little piece of the Sedra and what Rashi says of it. This is his Torah. And the mortal listens to it. And he tells him, did you hear that? Did you hear that? As if he had never heard this before, the mortal. As if he had never heard it. And he tells him, did you hear that? And he finishes saying it. He says, thank you so much. And the mortal says, I just want to repeat it now. And he repeats it, and of course nobody could repeat it as Reb Moshe repeats it. But a thing that he had seen a thousand times, as if this is the first time he's ever heard it, the first time he's ever said it. That was Reb Moshe. That was Reb Moshe. But I've heard the same thing from others. I've heard from Bonavie Jerome, my uncle. My uncle used to repeat sometimes what Reb Simcha Zisl said. You repeat what Rabbi Itzel Pitterberger said. There were times when he repeated, I gave a whole lecture. And he never didn't say anything about finished it. It was just out of this world. And afterwards he would sometimes say to me, what did you think of it? Now I knew he would never say, what did you think of it if it was his own. And if I said said, "Now, tell me, what did?" I said, "I thought it was wonderful." He said, "What did you feel wonderful about it? What was it?" And if I told him it was this, and he was very pleased, I understood it. He was very pleased. He said, "That was synthesis, or that was a bit of better madness." And when I met the grandchildren of Rabbi Tzur Petterberger, I discovered that when he said something, it was word for word as he heard it. Word for word. With all that enthusiasm, with all that freshness. That is how deep it all went. Now we are on the subject of MS. We are on the subject of truth. And this is all part of it. The point that I am making is how deep it all goes. If there is the understanding for it, and the sense of wonderment that comes out of it, and if it is a sense of wonderment, an overwhelming sense of wonderment, and one experiences the great thrill of this overwhelming sense of wonderment, and it's true, it's always like that. It doesn't fade. Because one has now hit the truth, and one is in the presence of truth, and one is relating to truth, and one is relating with the reality of it, and with the absolute reality of it. You don't become accustomed to it. You never take it for granted. But that is a level that one struggles to reach. And with all struggling, the delight is not in reaching one's destination, but the joy is in the journey itself. Thank you, ladies.